Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a March 3rd segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. With us tonight is Bruce McBurney for the second time. And Bruce, you are with us, aren't you?
Yes, thank you very much.
Very good. Welcome to the program again.
Thank you.
Well, you know, we really didn't get to talk about much in an hour the last time we got together, so it's very fitting for us to have another crack at this challenge of using the fuels that we're currently using more wisely and of eventually shifting away from them altogether. And that's been your life work for some 20 years at this time? Is that not right?
Well, over 25 years when I first started it. I've been playing with these things and trying to get this technology myself just to understand it, and then once I understood it, trying to get everybody else to understand what's going on with it all.
Okay, so for those who weren't present to hear the first interview that we did and who are unaware of your work, you have a website that we might as well get out there right away, which is HIMAC, H-I-M-A-C, correct?
Yeah, HIMACResearch.com.
HIMACResearch.com, and HIMAC is the acronym for?
High Mileage Awesome Carburetors, or actually it's got a few things. It does. MAC means son of, so it's a high son of. I'm just a name that come up with when I was thinking one time, because I said, well, if you have a name for a company, keep it short, keep it simple, keep it familiar. And that's just what I came up with, High Mileage Awesome Carburetors, and basically technology is being suppressed. And I learned this thing, and I'm trying to get enough people understanding this technology so that it will no longer be suppressed and we can change what's going on this planet.
Okay. And when we talk about suppression, it's necessary to believe that the suppression syndrome is perpetrated by more than just those who sell us their fuel. It has to also be perpetrated by the people who make the vehicles that use that fuel.
Yes, as well as the government has got to have some hand in it just to keep the controls for the corporations.
Yeah, because the government pretends to be interested in pollution and controlling it.
Mm-hmm.
But if they were truly interested in controlling pollution, then they would have insisted that these acts of suppression against efficiency would have been stopped a long time ago.
Yeah, that's for sure. And it's,
so it's sort of a trinity of collusion of three major powers then, isn't it?
Yeah, that's basically it. The oil companies, the car companies, and the government.
And then we really have to add academia in there, because the scientific community supposedly should be enlightening us as to what's possible. And although there have been some who've been bold enough to preach the message of increased efficiency, and there have been some mechanics and there have been some automotive engineers, but it hasn't really been much of a hallmark of their work to tell society that we're needlessly polluting this planet, because we could be doing much more with the fuel we're presently using.
Well, it's kind of just like everything in the academia. If it doesn't go along with the status quo, it doesn't go far. You're not towing the line in the schools. You're not in the schools very long. It doesn't matter, you know, what it is. If I've got a friend here from Toronto, and he's a teacher, and he's basically been trying to get the kids to think for themselves and, you know, get them educated and really get them to have a mind. He basically getting resistance from the school board. And anything
yes,
like that. Just even on the simple level like that, it happens. And all the different technologies, it seems there's a lot of suppression going on.
Yeah, very interesting, isn't it? Now, an example of this is that the most famous of all high-mileage carburetor inventors, that would be Charles Pogue, no doubt. And when he came up with his 200-mile-per-gallon carburetor in Winnipeg, I believe,
mm-hmm.
in 1934, is that when he first patented it?
Yeah, it was in the 30s there, 30,
and he supposedly demonstrated it to Ford Motor Company, and there is some documentation to that effect that they actually tested it and verified that it worked.
Yeah.
But they didn't run with it.
No. No, actually there was such a stir within the Toronto Stock Exchange that it caused the oil stocks to crash when the news first aired on the Pogue carburetor. But he was hassled, his shop was broken into, there was all kinds of different things that went down just to make it hard for him to go anywhere, you know.
Now, one of my guests actually went and met Mr. Pogue.
Oh, yes.
While he was in a nursing home.
Yeah. Yeah, I knew a fellow had met him in the nursing home, too, Brad Dennis.
Yeah, Brad Dennis, exactly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's been a guest on my show. And
oh, yeah.
He said Mr. Pogue had some photographs that he shared with him. Pretty interesting scrapbook.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, Brad has quite a collection of information from many inventors over the years.
But you've had quite an interesting career in delving into this also. And I say career because you do have a, what we call it, a publishing house of materials on this.
Well, yeah, just a little publishing company that I'm just trying to get it on. I've got my book and six other books on 100 mile per gallon carburetors, other titles that I'm republishing or reselling. I buy them and resell them. And I've also got the HydroBoost manual, which is a hydrogen build-on kit, and the works of Stanley Myers, as well as a couple of CDs. The CD from a fellow from Australia who tripled his gas mileage, and he has 500 pages of research and 140 AutoCAD drawings on the CD. And the other CD-ROM from David Steckling, owner of California, and his website's fuelvapors.com. And that's an amazing CD he's put together there. With that CD, your internet and your computer, you can view 930 of these different patented fuel-saving systems.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. And yeah. Wouldn't it seem that at this time in history, the automakers are going to start coming out with these devices on their vehicles?
Well, you'd think they'd be bringing them out now with everybody squawking about global warming, but from what I understand, they don't want to bring them out because they want to use the global warming as an agenda to promote the first the North American Union and then the basically one world government system that they've been trying to put upon us for many, many years.
Interesting. So you think there's an even larger political agenda involved in not... But it seems that they are coming out with vehicles that do 100 miles per gallon using other systems.
But not into the fuel cracking end of it. And that's the real answer, that you've got to reform and crack that fuel into a lower boiling hydrocarbon to get the true efficiency from the fuel.
Yeah, otherwise you're just spraying a liquid fuel in and expecting it to burn up in a millisecond, and it just ain't going to happen.
Yeah, no, it can't. It's got a multi-range boiling point. It's going to take time, and a lot of it just burns in the exhaust pipe or the catalytic converter.
Which is the way they like it, wasted fuel.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't really care about the air or the children's future. They just care about what's the pocketbook profits.
Yeah, and of course the common viewpoint is that they have actually muddied the water for those who want to crack the fuel by putting things in it that make it difficult to accomplish that easily.
Yeah, the anti-catalyst agents, right from the start, from the time of Pogue, and even, you know, there were other inventors before Pogue, 1919. I heard, and had this confirmed, too, by another fellow, that Rudolf Diesel, the inventor of the diesel engine, in 1919 had some way of tripling the gas mileage, and he wasn't getting anywhere in Europe, and he decided he'd get on a ferry boat and go to England. And the story is he died on the ferry crossing.
Really?
Yeah, slipped on a banana peel or something.
No.
Yeah. And Rudolf Diesel died in 1919 on a ferry crossing. And
so
they don't say anything about the fact that he was going about the super carburetor, but this is the scuttlebutt and the information that I've heard from a couple different sources. And I was telling this one other guy with the Discovery Channel about it, and he said, yeah, he researched it and he heard the same thing. But the interesting thing is this producer with this Discovery Channel, even though I sent him all the books that I sent you, he couldn't get the Discovery Channel to do anything on my information.
Well, I can believe it.
Yeah, he was kind of shocked. He thought they were opening up to this stuff, and then when he went in with the stuff, they just kind of shut the door on him.
Well, they try to paint it all as being, you know, fraudulent science.
Yeah.
It's wishful thinking. And then they do shows on things like ghosts and the Bermuda Triangle and whatnot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're willing to delve into subjects that are generally accepted as being somewhat fantastic. But they won't talk about the history of intelligent inventors, accomplished inventors, who've actually come up with devices that make the sponsor of their programs, fossil fuel, either obsolete or, you know, able to be used much more efficiently.
Yeah, you know, cut the profit ends. Yeah, it's and the like the status quo, though, like the Art Bell show years ago, I called in there and he says, well, I'm not talking anything about 100 mile per gallons till I drive a car 1,000 miles, and he hung up the phone on me. And I thought about it afterwards. I go, well, wait again a minute. This guy's a hypocrite. He's talking about flying saucers all the time, and he's probably never been in a flying saucer. He's talking about alien abductions. Did he ever get alien abducted? You know, and I've got all these different books and a stack of patents and all this information, and he won't even talk about it?
Well, and I think to that end, you could say that he's done a great disservice to alternative energy research, or at least the public's perception of it, because
mm-hmm.
it's put on the same plane as alien abductions and, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and a lot of the stuff, is, I believe all the alien stories, is nonsense. It's all, misinformation to take away from the fact that all the free energy is suppressed by the U.S. government right now.
Yeah.
The free energy, the anti-gravity, that's all, you know, I was told any flying saucer out there, well, that's just U.S. military technology.
Yeah, I think there may be some basis for believing that they had some craft flying years ago, decades ago, that could have caused people to think they saw something from another planet. But why don't we get to some of the interesting things that you are sure of that actually happened to you. For instance, you told me earlier today that you've had some interesting telephone conversations with people that you wish you had on tape, because it was quite surprising how the conversations went.
Yeah, I've had some very interesting conversations over the years. Some very interesting people. Alan Wallace was the one fellow we were talking about. Years ago, he wrote the book, The Secrets of the 200-mile-per-gallon Carburetor.
Okay, now I believe a friend of mine here in Lexington, Kentucky, ordered that. It was only like $3 or something. It was a booklet, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like $8 originally, $7.95
okay.
is where I saw it from the Farmer's Almanac.
And it was something like a magazine-sized publication.
Yeah, well, actually, the one was just done on the one that I got was just like on a cheap newsprint.
Right.
Very.
Yeah,
very,
that's what he got also.
Yeah, very, very cheaply done.
Like 8.5 by 11.
Yep. Yeah. And
booklet size.
And in the book, he had a variety of drawings and systems and patented systems that have come up over the years. He had a picture of the Pogue and Tom Ogles and all the different carburetor systems. And he had redone the book and changed the title because he was getting harassed by the post office for selling this book with the title Secrets of the 200-mile-per-gallon Carburetors. But he redid the book into another title, Super Mileage Carburetors, How They Work and How to Build Them, and another one, 200-mile-per-gallon Carburetors, Facts or Fraud. And they basically... you know, just again, shows all the different, you know, ideas of vaporizing and atomizing the gasoline One of the things, he didn't fully understand that you had to crack or re-refine the fuel. It was many of these inventors, and you know the books that I have, they did it. They got their 100 miles per gallon, but they didn't fully understand, you know, what they were actually doing in the chemical process of getting this 100 miles per gallon. They mostly thought they were just boiling and vaporizing it.
Well, I think that's true of most alternative energy inventors. Just because they may stumble upon, and I don't mean stumble from the standpoint of a total accident, but, you know, they're very dedicated researchers, perhaps, but ultimately they don't necessarily understand what it is that they've done. The physics behind it, the, you know, because how most of this stuff is done on atomic level, molecular level. How can anyone really be sure, especially without the expensive equipment that's necessary to?
Well, like you know, it's like I just kind of through the grace of God learned you know, the fact of this cracking and the aspects of how these things worked, because when I was doing my research on all these 100 mile per gallon carburetor systems, I was just basically trying to find out the boiling point of gasoline. And, you know, I went to a lot of mechanics and a lot of people, and I says, well, what's the boiling point? I'm going to vaporize the gasoline. What's the boiling point? Well, nobody knew.
Huh.
And, you know, and like right, I say, you can go out and find 100 mechanics and ask them what's the boiling point of gasoline. Out of 100 mechanics, you might get one that knows the right answer.
And that's because he's read your book?
That's usually the case.
Why else would he be concerned with it, huh?
Yeah, they just don't, they don't educate them on it. They don't let them know. They're not taught the different things because, you know, they don't want them to know the thing. That's an interesting thing, too, they did with the mechanics trade as well. When I went to high school, I was in grade 8 going into grade 9, and I was just a B student. Well, I wanted to study auto mechanics. Well, I was a B student. They didn't want me in auto mechanics. And the way it worked, if you were an A student, they put you in arts and science. If you were a B student, they wanted you to go to business. And, you know, if you were a C student, they put you into a technical, carpentry, or machine work. But if you were a D student, they got shuffled into auto mechanics.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I found that they did this all over North America for the last, you know, and like I went to school, like this is like 4 years ago that they ran, you know, did this on me. And like I've got a brother-in-law, and he's like 10 years older. He's retired as a mechanic. And when he went to, you know, grade 9, he was a B student. They didn't allow him to take auto mechanics. And it wasn't until, like, basically he got out of school, graduated, never took auto mechanics in high school, but worked in different things, and he, you know, and then every Saturday and Sunday, all he did was hang around the garage. So basically he decided, oh, I'll go and do his auto mechanics. But when I went, I was in grade 9, and they were, you know, it was kind of funny. I guess you could say I got a bit of an attitude, and I tell you, you know, but this guidance counselor was telling me, no, 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 you can't take this. And I'm saying, well, wait a minute. You're a guidance counselor. You're not a guidance dictator. Well, they didn't like that very much.
No, I reckon.
And I basically had to get a note signed from my father that I could go and take the auto mechanics course and go into this stuff. And then when I get into the auto mechanics course, I'm just a B student, all, you know, all the years before, not the top or anything. But when I get into this class with all these other guys, I'm the top of the student. I was the top in the class. Because everybody else was all these D students. And in Niagara Falls here where I live, they even had another school, a specialty school. Like, we had three high schools. Well, all the rebels and all the guys that were the real rambunctious ones, they went off to a this special high school for a two-year auto mechanic course. And they graduate, you know, with a grade 10 diploma, and they put them right off into auto mechanics. Well, that ain't going to get the best and the brightest in the field when you do that all around the world.
Isn't that something? You hear mechanics around here are charging as if they're lawyers or doctors. You know, you'd think that they wouldn't be viewed with such disdain.
Well, it's pretty bad. Now, it's not... might have changed in the last little bit. Like, I know now with my own son and stuff, they don't even give you the opportunity to do it. Now the mechanics are getting more technical, and you get, like, electrical technicians in there that, you know, have got a little bit more of an education, a little bit more of an understanding on it. But, yeah, it was amazing. And it's like, I'm not dishing all mechanics. Like, a lot of them were, you know, like my brother-in-law, he's a good guy, he's a smart guy. But, like I'm saying, the school didn't allow him to take the course.
Yeah, that's something.
Yeah.
Well, it's quite obvious that they don't want us being mechanics, the system, if you want to call it that. They really don't want us being like what our ancestors were. People even a generation ago, as I remember growing up in the 60s, that the average man in America was much more mechanically involved in his daily life.
Oh, yeah.
And that's apparently the way that the corporations want it. They don't want us repairing our stuff. They want it to be a totally throwaway society where all the Chinese junk we buy lasts a couple of years at most, and then we flip it over for something else.
Yeah, yeah. And the whole idea of the repair has been, how you say, discouraged, because sometimes, you know, you've got a $300 item. To buy one item in that $300 item, they want $150 for it.
Yeah.
So if you're going to go ahead and try and, you know, repair it, you got to pay $150 for one thing plus get your labor. Well, now you got a $200 bill for a $300 item. People will just go buy a new one.
Absolutely.
And you look at that item that they're charging $150 for, and I mean, it's only like, how you say, 1/20th of the $300, you know, piece of equipment.
Yeah, they don't want to sell parts.
No, they don't. The parts prices have gone crazy on stuff like that just to discourage that. And it's like, you know, when you look at it for, you know, I thought the drug companies were bad on some of the markups, but some of this stuff, you know, they're charging like $150 for the part, and you look at it, and, okay, that should be an $8 part.
Yeah, isn't that true? Okay, now, going on, you mentioned Alan Wallace, who wrote this book, and
mm-hmm.
you had told me earlier that he had claimed that this book had reached over 3 million circulation?
3.5 million people, he said at one point. And
that's incredible.
With all the different titles, you know, like the three different titles. But he said, yeah, he figured there was over 3.5 million copies sold.
Well, that represents a tremendous amount of knowledge having been spread over the past 20 years in just from his publications.
Yeah, that was in 1997 that I talked to him.
Yeah.
And I've never been able to get a hold of him since.
Now, are his things still being sold?
Yes, I still have his books. I know other people.
Other than
still
you,
have...
is anyone else? Is there any other publishing house or?
Yeah, I believe there's another publishing house. I've seen them out there in other places. There was a guy.
So you're not paying any royalties to him?
Not until he shows up at this stage of the game. I told him, I says, what I do is I basically do the books and I pay $5 royalty, like, you know, to the author. And he said to me, $5? He says, I didn't even get 50 cents a book for many of those books. And, you know, I says, well, that's what I do. And I got the original books. I got a bunch from them. And I says, now, if I can't get a hold of you, you know, I says, is it all right? And he says, oh, yeah, you go ahead and do that. And I says, well, you just show up in my driveway sometime, because basically at that point he was living in a motorhome. And his wife had taken sick, so they had stopped, and they were living with the son in Utah. And the son was on the internet because the father at that time was thinking, well, because they weren't, you know, they were staying in one place with looking after the wife in the hospital. He decided that he would republish his book, and he republished it in 97 on a computer, which much nicer and easier reading. And when his son was doing a little research, he found me on the internet, and we basically connected, and I connected him with Paul Pantone and Mike Haller, who were working with the GEAT system. And
okay, perhaps you could expound on that for people who are unfamiliar with what GEAT is.
Well, GEAT is apparently Paul Pantone's invention. He was from Utah.
So you found no evidence of anyone having done anything like the GEAT prior to him?
No, actually, there was other people saying that there was a patent in the 1930s that was similar to the GEET.
But you've never found it.
No, I haven't seen it. I don't know. It could be out there. I usually don't have a lot of time for follow-up research on some of the stuff. I'm just so busy doing what's coming in.
Well, let me ask you this. There is one of our regular callers on this show, guests on the show, Larry Jarbo of Charlotte Hall, Maryland. By the way, his sawmill property is going to be the site of a Woodstock of alternative energy devices this summer.
Oh, yeah.
The last weekend in June, anyone who wants to show up with an alternative energy device can do so. You don't have to have an invitation or they don't have to RSVP. Just show up, and there will be some prize money available.
Good.
And that'll be the 28th and 29th of June in Charlotte Hall, Maryland, at Jarbo's Mill. Well, anyway, Larry built a GEET several years back.
Mm-hmm.
And he's expressed the opinion that a GEET is nothing more than a vapor carburetor.
Basically, that's all it was, and I kind of got frustrated with Paul because, you know, he was saying, oh, yeah, you know, you can get 3 or 5 times the mileage with it, and with everything that I saw or built or had any of the people up here in Canada, and I had quite a few people build GEET systems, the very best efficiency we could get was about a 30% increase, and that's, you know, basically, it's not worthwhile 30% to do all that work with what he's got with that system. And, like, I got to the point where, okay, and he, Paul was basically, oh, try this and try that and try these other things. And I never could get it running any better. Well, I just kind of got fed up and walked away and, I just didn't want to deal with them anymore, and I'm going to work with somebody else. For a while with Paul, there were so many different weird things happening with him. I had other people and thinking that he was working for the oil companies to make all this stuff look bad and to make it look like, oh, it's all hokey. And, you know, he came up and he presented his stuff, and a lot of people said, oh, he looks like a carny, you know, like a carnival pitcher. And they just got turned off with his method and his talking, and they didn't even want to look at the technology. And it was funny because some of the people had known my technology, and, you know, like they knew and thought, you know, yeah, you're onto something. But when he came along, it was like, well, I don't know, now it's questionable. And I have his generator here, and I had a couple of demonstration engines, and finally when I could do a comparison, and I'm saying, hey, this is only getting 30%, and we tried a few things and never did get it to work any better, well, then we find out that, well, a lot of people don't want it more than 30%, because if it's more than 30%, then they say, oh, it's all going to go, you know, get suppressed, and if you can go up to 30%, then it's not a big deal. Now, what happened with Paul, a couple years ago, he got a little bit of trouble with the FCC, or the FCC caused a little trouble with him, and they took him to court, and they basically locked him up in a nut house.
And that's where he is to this day.
Yeah, he's been there for, I think it's over 2 years now, and it was weird, too, because somebody said that even if they would have charged him with the FCC ruling, he would have only had a three- or six-month sentence.
Hmm.
But he's been locked up in the nut house because that was the best way to suppress him. But Dennis Lee has gone ahead and taken and working with his technology. And I don't know if you saw in the March 2008 of Popular Science, it was PIC TV, some ads in there, and they're talking 121 miles per gallon on some cars.
So you're talking about a current issue of Popular Mechanics?
Popular Science.
Popular Science. And
yeah.
Is this an article or an advertisement?
An advertisement in it.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, like they look like they're trying to bring the technology out, but it doesn't seem to be going anywhere too fast. But
well, actually, I understand that the WIREC, WIREC convention in Washington, D.C., that's taking place right now, started today and runs through Friday, has a booth that costs $30,000 to erect that is dedicated to that technology.
to the
PICC.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and the other device. I guess there's two that they're trying to market together.
Yeah, as far as I know, it's the Hydro Boost or like my Hydro Boost manual, and the Geet system. The one is gives you moderate mileage improvements, and the Geet gives you better.
So they're claiming that the combination of the two is going to deliver.
Yep, the higher mileage.
And they're saying over 100 miles per gallon, or.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'd love to see it go. I'd love to see it happen. Would like to see some of the other inventors that are getting hassled straightened around and properly looked after for bringing their technology on. Like Paul worked for 10 or 15 years, and he promoted that technology so many different places. And I don't think Paul had a full understanding of what he was doing, and that's why there was a lot of discrepancies. And also, I think he had a lot of people that were kind of like constantly throwing a monkey wrench into his works.
Okay, well, that's one reason why I mentioned Larry. Larry attempted to define Paul's Geet system as a vaporizing carburetor, and
mm-hmm.
whereas Paul himself claimed that it had other physics taking place in the flow of the
reactor.
Yeah, in other words, you have two different directions in which the gases are flowing. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And then they call that a reactor because it basically causes the fuel to react and break down. Now, an interesting thing about that is, that rod that goes in the center of the reactor?
Yes.
Well, before, all the rods had like little, and there's like a half-inch rod in a 9/16-inch hole. So there's like a 1/32-inch gap around the rod. So that's where the fuel has to accelerate past the rod. Now, the thing is that rod is kind of like got little tits of welds, three of them on the rod that kind of hold its center within the other pipe. So you got that nice 1/32 of an inch gap all around the outside. Well, the problem that I heard, and I haven't been able to check it out, is that in order to tone it down so it wouldn't work really well, they didn't put they put it to welded tits on it. To make the Geet work properly, it should be little ceramic balls.
It should be isolated.
Electrically isolated so that it can build up that static charge. And
yeah, because that's supposedly that's key to the system working properly, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And like I say, there's a lot of things with what Paul said. It was like, I don't know, for a while whether to believe what was going on. But after looking back and all the different things, it was like, I believe this guy was just trying his damnedest to get the technology out. And, like he wasn't the best businessman. He was, and it all kind of
stressed. And that's typical. Most inventors aren't also good businessmen.
Yeah, but, it's also very emotionally stressful knowing this stuff and then having to deal with the people that you have to deal with because, some of them, like I know people with myself, they just look at me and they just say, oh, this guy's insane, he's a lunatic, he thinks he can get 100 miles per gallon, blah, and other people, they know, have heard of other stories of suppression, and, they think, oh, thank you very much for, taking your effort to share this thing, And, I've seen this and had to deal with this, even with my own family. For many years, my wife basically had my daughters convinced, well, the old man is nuts. He thinks he can get 100 miles per gallon. And it wasn't until my oldest daughter goes off to university and her boyfriend basically, learns my website, and he's there on a full scholarship. He's nobody's dummy. And he starts reading all my information on the Internet and is checking all the stuff out. Well, he said to my daughter, well, I don't think your father's crazy. I think he might be onto something here. Well, the next time my daughter comes home from the weekend, it's like I'm dealing with a different person. She doesn't look at me as if I'm a lunatic anymore.
Isn't that funny?
Oh, yeah, and I've had to deal that with a lot of different people and different things with family and friends, and it is, hard, And then you get these people that, you know, they think they're doing something for the environment, and they just kind of laugh you to scorn. Like, wait a minute, people. If we don't do this technology, you can recycle everything on the planet, and it ain't going to make a difference.
Yeah, in other words, just because someone's into the green environmental movement doesn't mean that they necessarily support inventors of these devices that would truly change the paradigm as far as what's causing all the pollution.
Well, as far as that goes, you'd think the environmental organizations would just seize on to this
stuff.
Yeah,
they don't. I know exactly what you're talking about.
They just ignore it or shun it. You know, like I have the one product I've been working with, the condensator, that's a PVC jar on the HydroBoost manual in my website. They should have one of these devices on every car on the planet.
Because it works. It's simple.
It works. It's simple. It's reliable. It's good for the car. It's good for the engine. It's good for the environment.
And what is it, the net result of installing one? What does it do for the mileage?
The mileage isn't that big. It's maybe only a 5 to 25% mileage improvement, depending on the car. It works on blow-by gases, so if you got a brand-new car that's fairly tight, not a lot of blow-by, maybe you only get a 5% mileage improvement. But you got some old oil burner that's just going through the oil and stuff, well, those ones will give you 25, 30% mileage improvement.
And clean up the exhaust stream.
Yeah, and clean up the exhaust stream, so like unbelievable. Like you should see the emissions reports we've had, you know, where cars aren't just 75%, but 500% cleaner on some of the numbers. Then not only you'll burn less mileage, your spark plugs will last longer. I had a fellow, he ran one of these devices for 340,000 kilometers, and he figured, well, he should probably change his spark plugs. So he pulled the spark plugs out, had a look at them, and put them back in.
Amazing.
Yeah, and you're not going to go through oxygen sensors, and as well as you burn less oil, I had a fellow with a 305 Chevy pickup truck. We put the device on, and as you run the device, it actually oil will accumulate within the jar, and you have to empty that every once in a while, depending on your car, how fast it accumulates. Well, this guy, he says, you know, I don't know. I've had this thing for 6 months. He says, when I first put it on, I was burning a quart of oil every 500 kilometers on the truck, and the jar would fill up pretty quick. He says, now I've had it on for quite a while. He says, it doesn't fill up with oil as often, and I'm only burning a quart of oil every 1,200 kilometers.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And, like, I went down to the Green Party here, and the head of the Green Party for the Ontario, and the local member, and all the newspapers are there, and they were having a talk, and I walked up, and you know, because I knew the guy from the Green Party, and I held this box up, and I said to all the people there, I says, with this one product that's been around for 30 years, well documented and proven, if we put it on every car and truck in Canada, we could meet Kyoto, and I have the documentation to prove it. And I didn't get one response from any of those reporters or anybody in the Green Party.
Yeah, they looked at you like you were not. And what is the cost of this device? Builds it themselves, what is it running?
Well, if you build it yourself, you can do it maybe $50.
Okay, $50.
Or there in a boat.
That it's cost prohibitive.
No. Well, I do the original condensator sold for $89 U.S., and that was many years ago. And then it went up to $109, and then we're up to $139 over the years it went up. Well, then the inventor died. Now they want over $300 for the device. And
is it patented?
Yeah, but it's over 30 years now. It's on a patent.
So anyone can manufacture and...
Yeah, in fact, I have an improved design that solves some of their problems. Like they had a little basket inside there with the catalyst material, and you really couldn't clean that catalyst material properly, as well as if you weren't careful, the basket thing would fall apart. Well, I've got a new design where I can, you know, once a year replace that catalyst material, and it's like, you know, 25 cents worth of material, and so you keep the unit working at peak efficiency all the time by putting new catalyst material in it once a year. And the whole unit that I figure with these things, you know, we should be able to sell them for, you know, $120 a pop. And you know, still the people that are selling them, and everybody can make a little bit of money. And I've been selling them here for, you know, quite a while. I just do a homemade version on one of these naphthalene styrene water bottles. You know, these new, no, that's not the right name of the plastic, I'm trying to think. Lexan. They have the new Lexan plastic, and they have these sports water bottles.
Right.
For the drinking bottles. Well, I make those into a condensator PVC jar, and I've been selling them. I sold a few of them here, $120. I usually charge $30 to $60 to install them. I charge, I give them a one-year money-back guarantee on it, and it's just been phenomenal, the results, and the people, you know, the mileage they're getting back, and they're telling their friends. And
what this is basically doing is taking what would normally be sucked into the carburetor as blow-by, right?
Yeah.
Back into the intake airstream.
Yeah, the excess oil vapors that are coming off the engine. And the, one of the reasons I like this, because this little device proves a 100-mile-per-gallon carburetor will work. Because if you think about it, you're taking a little bit of oil and gasoline vapors that are coming off the engine and running them over a catalyst, and you're getting 10 or 20% better gas mileage. Well, if you took all the gasoline going into the engine and run it over a catalyst and break it down, this is how you get the 100-mile-per-gallon carburetors.
And then the question comes up, if you don't have an oil burner, couldn't you simply use a small container of old oil?
No.
Somehow?
No.
It has to be in a gaseous form?
Yeah, it basically it's up to the... Well, you're better off, you know, like, okay, you got a nice tight engine and you're only getting a 10% mileage improvement with the condensator. Well, that engine's going to run for 350,000, 500,000 miles because it's just going to run so clean and so tight that... And another thing is you're not going to have to change your spark plugs. You're not going to have to change your...
And how do you explain that? Why is it running cleaner?
Well, all the crap that normally goes through the blow-by, that's what's fouling the engine up.
I see. So by breaking it down into more burnable compounds.
Yeah, and then the real crap that won't burn is collected in the jar.
I see.
And so everything that's in that jar didn't foul up your engine, your oxygen sensors, your spark plug, or our air.
Yeah. Now, is it improving the fuel efficiency because of aiding the combustion of the
yes.
gasoline?
Yeah, because the catalyst causes those vapors to break into lower boiling hydrocarbons. The lower boiling hydrocarbons burn faster and more complete.
So has anyone tried using a type of oil as a basis for a vapor carburetor to supply all the fuels the engine's fuel needs?
Not that I know of. I know you could probably take and run diesel fuel through a vapor carburetor and vaporize the diesel, or crack it is what you really need to do. I had some people that were trying to do it. I don't know how they've worked out, because, see, with the diesel, it takes higher temperatures to vaporize it and crack it, but because the diesel is not normally, you know, cracked, they don't put the anti-catalyst agents in the diesel. So it may be easier to do the diesel because they don't have that crap in it.
Yeah, maybe that's why they're changing the formula of diesel now, you know?
Possibly. I haven't kept up on all the different formulations on what they're doing, but I do know that, you know, that the additives that they put in, and they don't always put them in, these are the things that are inhibiting all these different inventors. You know, like that one book Larry Wagner owned, Pauley Up Washington, 1984, he had 7 shops set up installing 100-mile-per-gallon carburetors, and then they did a newspaper story about them. Well, within weeks after the newspaper story came out, everybody who had his carburetor systems coming back and saying, hey, this doesn't work anymore. Well, I imagine right after the newspaper story hit, the oil company saw that, and they just loaded up, you know, every gasoline station for 500 miles away from Pauley Up, Washington, that with all these additives in the gasoline. So it wouldn't matter, you know, what station you went to, you're going to get these additives. They're going to foul up your system. It ain't going to work no more.
Well, the petrochemical industry has the world's chemists. I mean, that's where they are.
Yeah.
So and they add, I understand they add a packet of additives to a gasoline tanker, in other words, a delivery truck. The actual driver of the truck will add these additives as he delivers to the different stations.
And they don't always put it in. That's why I'm saying, because that additive is very expensive that they have to put in, and so they don't always put it in. But if there's inventors or people that are working in that area, then they make sure they put it in to follow them up.
Isn't that something? And, you know, the average person on hearing this would think, you guys are nuts. They're not doing that. But they just don't realize that the billions and billions of dollars that have been made on selling this fuel have been earned because of doing this very thing.
Mm-hmm. And I've talked to different people that were drivers in, you know, drove the oil trucks, and they said, yeah, we'd get the additives, or they'd put it in at the station, or, you know, you'd see the guy, you know, right when you're getting the truck filled up, they'd come and they'd put the additive in, or they'd tell you, oh, here, take it. And some of the truckers would take the additive and supposed to put it in, and they wouldn't. They'd keep it, and then they'd sell it back to the oil companies because it's very expensive stuff.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, I thought it was wild.
That's unbelievable. That's almost funny.
Yeah.
And you know what's funny to me is, after having learned this history, and I've just learned it over the last couple of years. I'm not like you. I'm a newbie to this. But when I pull up to a gas station, certain brands in particular, and they brag about how they add things to their fuel, you know,
mm-hmm.
for cleaner gasoline and this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
And it just makes me sort of chuckle and makes me angry, really.
Well, you got to hear this latest story. I'm working with this fuel additive. It's Power Plus MPG. And it's just a little one-ounce bottle, and you just put, like, a few drops of this stuff in your gas tank, and you're getting, you know, 15, 20% better gas mileage. Well, the story I heard with this stuff is it was invented by a guy who worked for the oil companies down in Atlanta, Georgia. And he basically went to the executives of the oil company and said, hey, look, I got this fantastic little formula. I just put a little tiny bit into our gasoline, and everybody's going to get 15, 20% better gas mileage, and they'll all want to buy our gasoline because they're going to get 15% better gas mileage. And it's only going to cost a fraction of the you know, for this formula. So he, you know, pitched this idea to the oil company. The oil company fired him. This is something that they would want to put in the gasoline to make the gasoline work better. Well, this guy kind of got a little ticked off, and he went down to a church in Louisiana where the people are all messed up for the hurricane still and not working. He found a major church down there, and he says, here's my formula. Get it out there. So they set up a little multi-level marketing company, and they've been marketing this formula for a few years.
Isn't that something?
And it's a nice little fuel catalyzer, and I put it in my car, and I've noticed, you know, when I put it in, I'll get 75 to 100 kilometers more on a tank of gas. And I've sold quite a few bottles to, you know, friends and family and, you know, people, my customers with the carburetor stuff. And I'm getting positive feedback. You know, one couple, they went, you know, the people, Canadians go south to Florida for the winter time, so they, you know, they bought 5 bottles of the stuff, and, you know, they called me from Florida. They go, yeah, we got, you know, just as good a gas mileage on the American gallon as we do the Canadian gallon, and, you know, there's a 20% difference in the gallon size.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, they were quite impressed with it, and I've had other people say, oh, yeah, definitely more power, and a great little product, but there it is. The guy went to the oil companies wanted nothing to do with it.
Now, let's get into some of the other individuals that you've come in contact with, such as Jim Franklin.
Oh, yes. Yes. It was kind of funny. I was at a Toronto health show and coming home. My daughter says, oh, this guy called about the carburetor, you know, so I get home and I talk to this guy. Well, Jim Franklin was the partner of Tom Ogle. Now, in 1977, Tom Ogle called a press conference, and he allowed people to come and see this car. It was up on a hoist. He had a 351 cubic inch Ford Galaxy. The car was on a hoist in a garage. And he allowed them to look over the car for hidden fuel tanks on the car. And where the regular fuel tank was, it was removed, and there was a 5-gallon tank hooked up with the drain plug removed. So they searched the car high up and low down, and there wasn't a drop of gasoline on this car, and there was no lines or anything anywhere from the car hooked up into this other 5-gallon tank. So they put the plug in the gas tank, lowered the car off the hoist, put 3 gallons of gas into the car, and they drove out 100 miles. And there was reporters and camera crews and just all kinds of people. Apparently there was 500 people, buses and motorhomes and just, you know, all kinds of just going along for this demonstration ride. Well, they went from El Paso, Texas to Deming, New Mexico, 100 miles. They had a coffee, and they came back 100 miles. And they took the drain plug onto this 5-gallon gas tank after the 200-mile run, and they had a gallon of gasoline left over.
Huh.
Now, in my book, The Secret Super High Mileage Report, that explains 100 mile per gallon, I have 7 newspaper and magazine articles that were done in the 70s there about Tom Ogle. And it talks about the run and how they checked the car and had different people interview Tom Ogle in different magazines. And it also has in the magazine the fact that Shell Oil Company offered Tom Ogle $25 million for his invention, and he turned it down. And shortly later, he got shot, and didn't kill him, but shortly later after that, he died of drugs and alcohol, like a drug overdose. And, you know, there's an interesting sidebar to that. Not even 4 weeks ago, I had a guy call me up from El Paso, Texas. His friend knew Jim Franklin personally, and Jim didn't do no drugs. Everybody
or
else
Tom Ogle?
Was,
or?
Pardon?
Knew Tom Ogle, you mean?
Yeah. He knew this guy knew Tom Ogle, and Tom Ogle didn't do any drugs. And he knew him from El Paso, Texas, growing up as a kid. And so, you know, and I've had other people, you know, like get firsthand, you know, stories like that where they knew the people and the tie back and it just kind of.
I met one of them just today.
Oh, yeah?
My wife and I drove up to a little community about an hour from where we live, the town of Owenton, Kentucky, Owen County. And there was an inventor by the name of John W. Gulley. Now, Mr. Gulley apparently came out with 3 notable inventions. One of them was a high miles per gallon carburetor.
I was thinking that Gulley, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, supposedly he came out with a 100 mile per gallon on an 8-cylinder engine.
Mm-hmm.
And that was around 1950, from what I hear. I haven't established the facts of this timeline, but afterward he came out with an electric car that had some kind of magnet motor or something.
Oh, yeah.
And then after that, he came out with still another version of a car that required no fuel. So today, I spoke to a gentleman who was working as a telephone lineman, and he would regularly service lines around Mr. Gulley's property. And he said he would drop in and speak to him regularly because he was interested in what he was doing. He said that Mr. Gulley was discouraged and explained to him that he had been bought out and that the invention had been shelved.
Oh, yeah.
And it was fascinating to hear a guy tell me face-to-face his recollection of something that he learned firsthand in visiting the inventor. And we're talking 34 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, well, on Sundays I do a flea market here, and I have all my different books, and I was saying I wished I had a little camera just, you know, to catch these different people, because, you know, people come by, and I say, oh, you ever stuff on 100 mile per gallon carburetors, and some people look at me as if I'm sane, and then other people will walk up, and they say, oh, yeah, you know, I knew this guy, or I knew this, or whatever, and I had this one fella come in, and I says, oh, you know, you ever heard of my? He says, oh, yeah, I got one. I says, oh, what'd you do, build yours? He says, nope. And I says, well, what'd you do, buy a car with one in? Because, you know, like you hear these stories where people buy a brand new car.
Right.
And they're getting this amazing mileage. Well, they say it's a prototype. I say it's an executive car. But at any rate, this guy says, nope, I didn't buy one. And I said, well, where'd you get it? And he says, he looked at me and looked around. He says, I stole it. And I says, what are you talking about? He says, well, you know how when General Motors buys up all these inventions? He says, they put them in this room. And this is like St. Catharines, Ontario, okay, up here where they have a big GM plant. He says, and this other company that was affiliated with General Motors was McKinnon Industries. And he worked for this place. And he says, you know, he was in there and just, you know, cleaning around and checking stuff out. And he got into this room. And here's this room, and it's like all these different prototype inventions that have been bought up by General Motors.
What an interesting story.
Yeah, well, he saw this one, and he recognized it and go, you know, like it was the intake manifold and the carburetor all on the top, and they basically put it in a garbage bag and put it out for garbage and, you know, got it onto the plant.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, he says, I had the RCMP at my house 3 times. They ripped my house and one end to the other. They, for sure, I stole it. They knew I stole it. He says, but I didn't put it on my own car. I put it on my buddy's cars. We put it on my buddy's car. We screw off down to Florida or Las Vegas, you know, doing 75 mile per gallon on a 350 V8.
Huh.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Oh, yeah. And just the other day, I had another guy, you know, come in and says, oh, yeah, he knew this guy from the 1950s, and, yeah, he got suppressed, and, you know. But it would be neat to collect all these little video segments of these candid, you know, confessions of these different people and their little stories and testimonies.
Yeah, and I know that some of them are false stories. They're, you know, exaggerations, and many people say that it was someone that was related to them or that they knew real well. And I'm just sure that a lot of these stories are fictional, but then again, there has to be some of them that are true.
Well, I got a pretty good thing for, you know, knowing a line of bull, because I've had people tell me stuff. But most of these ones, the people are very sincere. They're kind of being just, you know, they like to share it. It's kind of like, I don't know, if you ever noticed it, you know, people, you tell them, oh, yeah, I saw a flying saucer one day. Well, if you're in a group of people, the next thing you know, somebody will walk up to you and they'll tell you their flying saucer story. But had I not related the fact that I had seen this flying saucer or something going across the sky that I would never identify as an aircraft, and any, I've seen many airplanes living in Niagara Falls, you get all the tours and stuff and everybody comes around and we get the B-1 bomber every time there's an air show within 200 miles of the place. But I knew what all these, and so something went across the sky. It was what I would call a UFO. Well, just simply because I would share that with other people will share their stories.
Yeah,
with
and
me.
That's why it's very important for you and I and others who are doing this kind of work, bringing this stuff to the fore out in public, because we're, especially when you're talking about elderly people, people who remember something that happened in the 40s, 50s, 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're in their 80s or 90s even, and they're not going to be around much longer. So it's important for them to come out of the woodwork and share what they knew.
Yeah, but only because, you know, here I am sharing my information. That's why, like, all these people will come back and share their story.
Exactly.
And when, you know, a lot of them, you know, you hear the ring of truth or, you know, like you say about that John Gully, I can look it up and find the patent probably for the guy if he got a patent on it. You know, well, when you start seeing, well, gee, there was a patent filed on this guy's name, you know. It was like Alan Caggiano. You know, everybody thought, well, this guy's wacko. Well, he did file a patent. And
okay, that's something we wanted to talk about. We've only got a couple minutes remaining. Why don't you talk about John? That was a phone call, I think you said, that you wanted to share. An unusual phone call. Is that right?
What, the ex-CIA fellow?
Regarding him? I'm confusing it. Well, go ahead about John, because most people don't know who he is.
You mean Alan?
Alan, I'm sorry. Yeah, maybe perhaps you can give a brief description of who he was.
Alan Caggiano basically had his own refrigeration air conditioning business in Massachusetts, and about 15, 17 years ago now it was, I guess, he had been working with gas. It was a weird thing. He was cleaning on a refrigeration coil, and he didn't have the right solution to clean the thing out, so he thought, oh, I'll just clean it out with gasoline. Well, because the aluminum reacted with the gasoline, he put a lot of liquid in, but all he got was a lot of vapor on. So he's trying to collect the liquid, and where did the liquid go? Because it's, you know, the aluminum causes, you know, breakdown of the gasoline. So he got thinking about it, and he had a half a dozen trucks on the road, and he had quite a gas bill for all his trucks, and he started, you know, playing around with the carburetors. Well, he had a Dodge Coronet station wagon, 318 cubic inch, getting 113 miles to the gallon. And he, you know, started talking it up and getting things going. And, well, the next thing you know, his wife's getting threatening things in the mail and 8x10 glossies in the mailbox of the children getting off the school bus and her in the grocery store and, you know, scare, you know, everything kind of, you know, oh, you got to stop all this stuff, you know. And Alan was, you know, adamant. No, he says, I think we can do it. Well, then the wife gets all upset. Well, the next thing, there was a fellow comes by, and they were wanted to investigate in the technology and invest in it. And so these people who want to invest in it, Alan had his lawyers check them out. And the lawyer says, oh, these people are nothing more than a front for an oil company. They're just going to buy it up and put it on the shelf. And Alan says, well, that's not going to happen. So the next time they come, he says, oh, you're a front for an oil company. He kicked them out of the house. Well, 3 days after that, the chief of police from Brockton, Massachusetts, knocked on Alan's door and says, oh, you're the guy with his claims 100 miles per gallon. And he comes in, and he drops cocaine on the floor that the deputy walking behind finds, and they try to bust Alan for this cocaine. Well, Alan basically was a church-going Christian. He didn't like drugs, and not only that, with the refrigeration air conditioning business, he was connected to a lot of police department in the Boston area. And even though he was in maximum security, he had enough of a connection with the police department that they proved the drugs that they found in his apartment came from the evidence locker, and this chief of police was basically charged with, you know, framing the guy.
Wow.
However, at the time when Alan was busted, he, you know, had a couple shotguns he got for skeet shooting. He says skeet shooting and neighborhood protection, but he says when he went to fill out the applications for the shotguns, he never thought anything about it. It said, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And, you know, when he was 18 years old at graduation, there was one of the guys broke in and stole some liquor, and they had a misdemeanor charge, and there was no big deal of it. And so he thought, oh, well, that wasn't a felony because, you know, didn't even go to jail or anything. And he ticked the box, no. Well, here it is many years later that they're busting him for this cocaine, even though they proved the cocaine was a frame-up. He had these guns in his possession, and he said that he didn't have a felony. Well, the state of Massachusetts called his charge a misdemeanor, but because alcohol was involved in his charge when he was a kid, the feds called it a felony, and they put him in jail for 15 years.
You've got to be kidding.
On a weapons charge.
On what began as a frame-up anyway.
Well, by the grace of God, his cell partner's son was going through to be a patent agent. And from the gist, and he wouldn't tell me a lot, but from the gist of it, they built these systems. He was in jail in Massachusetts for 10 years. And they built the systems and patented them when he was in jail. And he told me one time, he says, yeah, we got 7 different cars driving around with these things, and, you know, they're on tractors and lawnmowers and stuff. Well, I realized later, yeah, it was probably the guards and the warden's cars and the tractors and the lawnmowers at the jail cell.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So, in other words, because no one on the outside had ever demonstrated one of his devices.
Well, he had some people had seen the demonstration of the one, and then the government stole his car. And he tried to get the car back, and that was a whole stink. And then, yeah, they got him on some weird charge, and they had a police officer investigate him. And then when he went to court, the police officer that did the initial investigation basically got up and said, Well, you know, I think this guy was just an inventor trying to get his product out. Well, the police officer wasn't supposed to say that. And, I think it was 2 to 3 weeks after, and because what the police officer said, the charges were dismissed from Allen, and he got walked onto the court. He was supposed to get his car back. And the 2 to 3 weeks later, the police officer that did the investigation, it was found that he had $5,000 and a bunch of cocaine in his locker at police department, and they kicked him out of the police department.
Huh.
Because, you know, that was what Allen said, that he had not played their game right, and he had testified for Allen rather than against him. And this young cop, he was a pretty decent guy. He couldn't, you know, trash Allen and what he was doing, because yeah, he actually thought Allen was doing something good.
Isn't that something?
Oh, yeah. But
now, these events happened how long ago?
About 3 years ago.
Okay, so fairly recently. This is after he got out of that 10-year sentence.
Yeah, and at one time, with all these things happened a couple years ago, Allen basically disappeared, and nobody heard from him for quite a while, and I didn't hear nothing, never, you know. And there was a bunch of people, you know, that they were trying to bring a unit under production, and they had sent him money to bring these one little units that he was supposed to produce, and then he just disappeared. Well, everybody says, oh, he just took off with all the money, he's a fraud. So, I don't know, a couple, 3-4 weeks pass, and I get this phone call from Allen, and Allen says, I'm in the hospital. They've been trying to kill me. They've been keeping me in a coma. He says, they put me on a resuscitator, and the resuscitator's not breathing enough. And he says, the one nurse, they were giving me extra insulin and trying to put me into insulin shock and all his other things, trying to kill him. And he's telling me, you know, then, you know, about the being in the hospital. And I'm kind of blown away with that. And it wasn't like 2 or 3 days later, he calls me up and he says, you won't believe it. I'm in the hospital here, and I'm watching the TV news, and they just raided my apartment, took all the books, my computer, and everything out of my apartment, and they seized my car. And this is on that charge that guy, you know, the young officer testified. This is what, you know, this happened before. Well, when this happened, you know, I'm thinking, well, you're right. I don't believe them. It was just too weird to believe that, you know, that they were, you know, doing all these things. So, just, you know, basically my instinct was, okay, I don't believe them. It sounds too weird. I hung up the phone and I dialed the information. And I said, you know, the 555-1212 in the area code. And I says, hi, I'd like the phone number for the Chelmsford Police Department. So, you know, they give me, directory assistants give me the phone number, so I call up and I talk to the desk sergeant. Hi, I'm doing an investigation on this Allen Caggiano. Kind of played the devil's advocate, you know, because I am investigating him. And,
sure.
And I wasn't lying to anybody. And just, you know, I'd like to know what's going on. He's making all these mileage claims. And the investigating, the desk sergeant, I talked to him maybe for about 3 to 5 minutes, and he says, oh, just a minute. The investigating officer walked right in. You can talk to him. So I talked to this investigating officer for a bit, and when, you know, Allen had said about this fact that, you know, he got this frame-up charge with the cocaine years ago and all these other things, and I didn't know how to, you know, for what he was saying and all these other things, it was kind of overwhelming. So when I'm talking to the investigating officer and I says, well, this Allen Caggiano's got quite a story to tell. He says that he got framed for cocaine and the chief of police got busted and all this other, and the investigating officer came back and says, yeah, most of that's true.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And he says, well, I don't know the whole story, but yeah, most of it's true, you know. Like, it just kind of blew my mind. And then I ended up talking to the Lieutenant Rourke. And I, you know, then after I talked to the lieutenant for a bit, and I didn't know, you know, what this guy was about and everything, and then I came and I said, well, you know, I think Allen Caggiano's an honest inventor. I've basically investigated these 100-mile-per-gallon claims and found them to be very true, and there's a lot of suppression going on with these things. And the lieutenant was kind of intrigued, and I said, well, if you're, you know, interested, I'll send you a copy of my book, let you read it, and let you understand, you know, what's going on. So I mailed him the book, and later, well, then, like Alan said, it was like, shoot, the lieutenant became like he went, you know, started really going after Alan, like really starting to harass him. And then the lieutenant, next thing you know, he became the chief of police. And he moved up quick, and Alan says he bought a big new house. So he don't know what the hell's happening down there. But at any rate, last Christmas, Alan called me, well, before Christmas in December, and called me up and says, well, there's something going on down here. I got a big a black van out in front of my house, and I know they're watching me. And he says, I'm not sticking around here. So apparently he went out the back door and across the yard and had a friend pick him up and walked away from his house, and he was living at different places. And, you know, staying at friends a few days here and a few days there. And then I didn't hear from him for a while, quite a while. He called me up just between Christmas and New Year's and said, you know, oh, it was getting too hot, and this other guy that was supposed to be helping him, he turned out to be working for the CIA, and he ripped him off for some money, and now he can't pay these other guys. And this guy was supposed to be bringing this thing out, and he's got these orders, and he's, you know, he says, I don't know what to do, you know. And didn't talk much more, and he says, well, we'll see what happens. And then on January 16th, he called me, and it's over a year now, and he called me, and he says, well, I decided to go to China. He says, it's too hot in the United States, and he on the Skype computer thing, and it, you know, showed Skype China. And we talked, and like, okay, he's settling in China, and we'd talk again, and I never heard from him since.
Huh.
Not once. And other people that were working with him and trying to help him, and you know, one guy wrote the story and stuff on him, nobody's heard from him.
And so what was the nuances of his system? What was he producing?
Well, his first system that was his patent was a three-stage vaporizer. And, you know, I've actually seen others that are very similar, because what they're doing is they're heating the fuel in stages, you know, rather than just going to 500 degrees to try and vaporize it. You know, they'll start off at 150 and 250, and then, you know, in each different stage it gets hotter. And that's a good way of doing it, so you don't get you're just kind of carboning up the molecules. But his later on, he was doing what's called the FIV-3 system, and the other system that he had basically was a system that would take the fuel and you pressurize the fuel up to 250 psi, and then you would put the fuel in this container that had a heater, and they'd heat it up to 650 degrees Fahrenheit in the presence of these catalysts and these magnets, these four big magnets. And it would apparently reform the fuel into another lower boiling hydrocarbon. It was kind of like it would change the fuel. Like, see, normal gasoline's got a boiling point from 130 degrees all the way up to 430 degrees. And so normally the spark fires, it's at 130 degree gasoline burns first, and it goes through the layers. And usually by the time the exhaust valve opens, the gasoline has got a boiling point of 350 degrees up to 430 degrees. That's burning in the exhaust manifold or in the catalytic converter. You know, you've seen the flames come out of the stock cars and, you know,
right.
just all that's all wasted energy. Well, what he was doing with his system, he was reforming the fuel so that it all had a 130-degree boiling point. And you just put that same fuel right through the regular carburetor, but because now it's all got the same boiling point, well, you just touch your gas pedal and you're spinning your tires.
Huh.
And it just go like crazy. And I had other people go down, and they drove the car, and they said, yeah, you know, you just touch the gas pedal and the thing's just smoking and just, you know. But the concept was that you're reforming the fuel, and he was trying to get it to stabilize, but it wouldn't stay reformed. You know, like basically I think it was making a radical molecule, like a charged electron to make up for the short molecule. But that's why what they did one time with the fuel, they would run it through this system, and they took and they put it in a motorcycle. They made no other alterations to the motorcycle. They just ran the fuel through this conditioner, and they put it in the motorcycle. Well, the motorcycle basically went like a bat on a hell, and it got three times the gas mileage. However, the next day, the fuel had sit in the metal tank of the motorcycle all night. It was just normal. The gasoline would revert back to its normal self, and the motorcycle, would get the same regular gas mileage, the same power. Where the day before, because the molecules were charged and broken up or whatever they did, and just amazing the difference.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Sort of like a drink if it's left out, huh?
Kind of like that.
A carbonated beverage losing its...
Yeah, yeah.
Going flat or something, huh?
Well, see, to break the molecules down, you have to have oxygen molecules, hydrogen molecules. Like if you're going to change it into a lower boiling hydrocarbons, there's always has to be an addition of hydrogen molecules because there's like molecular bonds to be like natural gas. It's C1, one carbon atom, and four hydrogen molecules. But gasoline will be like C8, like an octane, and it may have 18 carbon molecules. Well, to break that C8 into the C1, well, you only got 18 molecules. For 8, you're only going to have like 3 molecules per carbon molecule, so that's insufficient. But what I'm thinking is happening is it's a radical where they don't need an extra molecule. They just put an extra electron in. And if they have the extra electron for the bonds, then you end up with like if it was a natural gas in a radical, instead of being C1H4, it would be C1H3 with an extra electron. So that it would give it that lower boiling, but again, that extra electron, after a period of time, would discharge, and then it would make those molecules form back. Instead of being C1, it would form C2 or C3s or, bigger molecules and take away from your actual mileage improvements.
Very, very interesting. Well, look, we've come to the end of our time, and why don't we mention one more time how people can order books from you so they can learn more about these easy adaptations that could be done to virtually all gasoline vehicles to make the current usage of fuel quite obsolete. And so that's HIMAC Research?
Yes, just go to the website, HIMACResearch.com. I've got all my contact information and phone. If you drop me an email from the website, I can send you to other websites and I'll give you a list of all the different books and information I have. I am set up now to take credit cards, MasterCards, Visa, AMX, and all the cards just through phone-in orders. Just trying to get the information on any which way I can.
Well, you're doing an excellent job, and I commend you for it, and look forward to us getting together and talking again, because there's still a lot more information to cover.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
And I thank everyone for joining us.
Thanks. Have a good night.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.